Now we're here in the WGXC Hudson studio live with Representative Chris Gibson and the publisher of the Columbia paper, Perry Teasdale.
Hi, and welcome, Congressman. It's a great delight to talk to you in Hudson. And I wanted to start today with something that just came to my attention, which is, you know, we've been talking a lot in various circles in this county, as you well know, and a lot of other places about high-stakes testing. And it's been a hot issue. And I know that you've submitted an amendment to the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that would reduce the amount of testing required in the federal government and apply a principle called grade span testing. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, I sure can. And first of all, just thank you, Perry. Thanks for the work you do with the Columbia paper. And to Tom, congratulations to you on a new show. And we appreciate this channel. You know, thanks so much for what the radio channel does for our community. So this is a very passionate issue. So many parents, so many teachers, administrators, students, very frustrated with the direction of where education has gone, particularly since 2001, the No mm-hmm. Child Left Behind. This was George W. Bush. He worked it in a bipartisan way. I respect the former president and those that supported the principle, but I've always been opposed to this because at its core, pun intended, you know, this has really been about centralizing education, one size fits all, homogenizing graduates, relying on unfunded mandates. In other words, we know what to do, but you figure out how to pay for it. And, of course, onerous high-stakes testing. And when you listen to teachers, as I do, I'm in schools about 2 to 3 times a month, all my school districts across the 11 counties. What you hear from teachers is they feel frustrated because they constantly have to teach to the test. And, you know, what's happened is with the advent of not just Common Core, but really this No Child Left Behind, which was the onerous high-stakes testing, we went from when I was a lad. I mean, we had the Stanford, Binet, and, you know, we had the Iowa tests. But what we did is we adopted these math and English annual testing periods, extensive, 3 days, basically almost a whole week. And we made them not only onerous, but we made them high stakes. We were grading schools and teachers based on the outcome of these tests. And so what happened is the culture is there was a feeling that we had to teach to it because there was so much at stake with that test. So what I did is I went back and took a look at where we used to be, which was you got tested once in a grade span. So, you know, 3 through 5. 6 through 8, and then in high school. And we, of course, reject and remove the onerous and high stakes of it and then change the frequency. Our study, we had it was looked at. It was going to save over $1 billion that we could have reinvested in education. So, you know, the components of the bill were to reduce the level of frequency, change the nature of how the tests are used so that they be truly diagnostic, and then reinvest that money back into schooling.
What was the fate of the bill?
Well, we were blocked. We got a lot of support, a lot of bipartisan support. Unfortunately, it was blocked in the Rules Committee. And the reason it was blocked is there was a belief that it could cause the unhinging of the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, mm-hmm. which the success side of this is we actually rolled back No Child Left Behind, which was a big win. Getting that done, we that annual yearly progress, AYP, that mm-hmm. I was alluding to earlier, is gone now. There's no federal requirement for that. Also, the linkage of teachers being evaluated based on these onerous high-stakes tests is gone. So that's been completely eradicated at the federal level. What we did is we moved the loci of power back to the states. You know, in just about every other state in the union, that's a really good thing for those who believe, as I do, in empowerment. Unfortunately, in New York, it's not as a great thing because, of course, sending the power back to Albany, unfortunately, our leaders are still wedded to the Common Core. We, for example, we now can withdraw from Common Core without federal penalty if we wanted to, and I think we should.
I've called, and that's law now.
Yes, yeah. That's federal law. I've called on the governor to do that, and he has not done that. But let me tell you, even though our bill did not become law, when you listen carefully – and by the way, I need to say one more thing. Part of it is some of the minority communities were really concerned about walking back on the testing because to them it's a civil rights consideration. They want access to a high-quality education. I couldn't agree more with that sentiment. I just disagree with the pedagogical approach of using testing, onerous testing, to get there. So,
but the testing came up, not but, but I think historically the testing came up because children were being cheated out of an education. I mean, they were graduating without knowing that they were uneducated.
So this is clearly, yeah, I mean, that was part of, well, that was a belief anyways. Mm-hmm. I had some other thoughts on that. I think that we got too concerned about metrics that I believe were apples and oranges. So, for example, people say, well, we're 16th in this category. You know, we're 18th. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. When you look at many of these countries overseas in Europe, they don't test everybody. They only test those that are going to go on to college. So if you look at your denominator, and our denominator is, well, everybody, and if you look at the denominator in European countries and it's maybe a third, well, then you're going to get a distorted viewpoint of what the results are. I've always maintained that. So anyways, here's one thing that was good, that not only did we get rid of No Child Left Behind, but we also, on testing, we actually created a pilot that five states can actually enter where they can actually do their own assessments. So I was actually pleasantly surprised there because I called on the governor and the state to apply to be in that pilot, and they actually did it. So, you know, if we end up going into this pilot, it could very well be that we can make major improvement with rolling back onerous high-stakes testing.
Let's turn to another topic now that you've worked hard on, which is broadband access. And Has it advanced at all since you started working on it? And where are we now? What's the
little
update?
Bit? Not much. To be candid with you, it has not. I'm very frustrated on this topic. I could name you certain areas, and in fact, even in our own county, we've had some modest gains, 1-2 yards, cloud of dust. But you know, given the fact that we actually have some significant pots of federal money that have been appropriated but yet not used, you can imagine why I'm so frustrated. For example, you know, we have two pretty significant pots of money for expansion of broadband. One is in the Farm Bill, and that's the Rural Utilities Service. And then the other one is with the FCC, is the Connect America Fund. That's actually a bigger pot of money. That's in the billions, $4 billion, but yet only a fraction of it's used. And so, you know, myself and a bunch of others, we wrote to the chairman of the FCC, Mr. Wheeler, mm-hmm. and we said, please change the rules when it comes to the Connect America Fund, because really the only companies that were eligible were your big corporations, Verizon, you know, all the other companies.
So this would fund private corporations or a build-out of
build
higher.
Yeah. Okay. So, but the issue is that if they don't feel that they're going to make a lot of money, mm-hmm. then they don't use the money. They don't use even the money.
So it can't be used to subsidize what they
no,
do?
No, it can be. The problem is that these companies, even with that subsidy, some of them have elected not to use it. So a lot of this money
Mid-Hudson Cable did that a couple years ago. They got a grant, and they decided not to use it for broadband.
Right.
And did they give a consistent reason why that? It's just not profitable enough to maintain it over the long term? Or what is the...
In essence, that was it. Yeah. In some cases, it was capital. Mid-Hudson Cable, I believe, was actually a capital concern. But, you know, we're not resting on this. We're trying a million different ways to get to the end zone. So the latest thing is, first of all, I think many of us were just really hopeful that the state money, the $500 million, was going to be the real solution for us. But unfortunately, again, the first round there, the rules have been written. So essentially all the money's going to go to urban big areas. If you have less than 2,500 people, you can't get access to this. If you are tied up with Time Warner, you can't get access to it.
Tied up with Time Warner because they are in merger talks?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So, look, I mean, I can understand perhaps on one hand, but, you know, when you're trying to build out rural capacity for broadband, you got to take this into consideration. Like, for example, Columbia County, we are trying hard to build out in our county, and yet only 4% of the county was eligible for the state money. So what we did here is we held a meeting and we brought in experts of a federal program called E-Rate. E-Rate is a subsidy program for schools and libraries and public safety entities.
Right.
And so, and myself and
that's been around for a while.
It has, yeah. But we've actually improved it. Jared Polis and I, he's a Democratic member from Colorado. We wrote to the FCC, very pleased. Again, Mr. Wheeler has been pretty responsive. When mm-hmm. I've written to him, I always get a response, and he always listens and thinks through. And so he actually changed the rules for E-rate, and now we can actually get a better reimbursement here. Mm-hmm. And so that's a strategy that we're going to use to build out the backbone, if you will, for Columbia County.
And is it going to be stringing copper wires or going to be over the air?
No, it's fiber.
It's fiber. So it's still one technology that we're looking at, not a mix of technologies?
We're doing with E-rate is fiber. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're in the marketplace, there is variegation. Because a lot of our constituents here in Columbia County, of course, have Fairpoint. Fairpoint is going over copper wire, the DSL, and those that some have Time Warner, and they do have the fiber in some cases. And then, of course, Verizon has lately been moving to the 4G. They've been going to the wireless. So it is variegated in the marketplace, but as far as what the federal program, we're still trying to lay out fiber. I believe that when you look at all factors, including how temperamental that DSL is, and even 4G can be, particularly given some of our August days and what it looks like with bringing thunderstorms on and everything else. And we have benefited. If you look at Columbia County, I mean, the things that we are generally really strong at are agriculture and tourism. And what we also have seen is we've seen a growth. Look, we're talking in Hudson here, and you look at Warren Street, and you see how much antiques have made a comeback. And so we have a fair number of folks who have moved up here, at least part-time, from New York City. And this is an issue. We can actually get more growth in the county, and the growth that the kind that we like, more investment in the county, if we can get more broadband.
What would be the next ideal thing to happen? In other words, what could people look for and say, oh, if this happens, then we'll get some more service?
So here's what I would tell you. One is this E-rate course of action that we're developing, that we follow through on that. We've talked to the board. We've met with the school boards as well, and that's key. And then hopefully the state will change their rules. And when they do, it'll be match money. And then that will be the big turnover here to make sure that we get more broadband.
Okay. Let's move on to health. What's the status of your Tick-Borne Disease and Accountability Act?
Thank you. Yeah, so it has passed the House. Very excited about this because we really think that this is going to help us get the guidelines that are going to be helpful for diagnostics, for treatment, and for healthcare insurance company coverage, which is woeful right now. It's really inadequate. And, you know, what our bill does is it requires diverse scientific viewpoints. It forms an advisory group. And that group provides specific recommendations for the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And ultimately, we believe it's going to bring more accountability to the research because, look, I mean, many of us, myself included, have wanted to see more dollars to go to NIH for this research. But what's also important is it goes to the right places. And unfortunately, the medical community right now is divided on whether or not chronic Lyme exists. It absolutely. I mean, we've got people who are sick. And so, but these guidelines, this bill is going to help us get forward new guidelines. Now, I must tell you that we did get a win because we've been beaten on this for years. The good news is they finally vacated the old guidelines that were so narrow that it was leading to people not getting diagnosed. It was leading to inadequate treatment protocols. The good news is those old guidelines are gone. They've been vacated. Here's the challenging news. We haven't got the new guidelines in place. This bill is going to help. It has passed the House. The president has issued a statement of support, and we're hoping the Senate will move on it.
Okay.
All right. We're going to take a little break in just a second and be back with Representative Chris Gibson talking more about Lyme disease and what else is going on in. All right. We're back in the WGXC Hudson studio with Representative Chris Gibson from Kinderhook and talking to Perry Teasdale from the Columbia paper.
One thing we were just as we left and went off the air for briefly there was that you said you had some news about infrastructure. And I think that's on people's minds because we all drive over the roads and we're worried about the bridges.
Thank you, Perry. Well, you know, we worked together and we enacted a very meaningful bill. One of the issues we've had at the federal level is we've been basically before we got this bill, we've been patching 30 days, 90 days, in one case, 2 years. That was the longest we had done. But we hadn't done a major piece of legislation to give certainty to the planners and to those that are in this space that do the work, the great work in infrastructure. We just got a robust 5-year bill. And what it means for New York is we're going to get a 10% increase in the federal investment in our roads and bridges and water and sewer. So it is certainly needed. I mean, our state.
So it will go to water and sewer as well as highways and bridges.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's good. And so I'm excited to have been the part author of that. I had an amendment on bridges, which is so important. We have over 7,000 bridges here in the state that are either structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. And I was proud to get the support of both sides of the aisle on that. In fact, the ranking member, the ranking Democrat, really applauded the amendment, and it passed universally. So thanks.
Well, this is, I think, an appropriate segue to your thinking about climate change has evolved since you ran for office first time, and now you've introduced a resolution calling for the House to plan for the impact of climate change. But I'd like to know what you think this district needs to do as we plan here for climate change. What do you think?
That's a great question. So a couple things. I mean, one is that when you look, climate has been changing since time out of memory. At one time, we had dinosaurs that walked the Earth. Some people think the theory for why we don't anymore is related to the changing climate. What's different this time is we are contributing to this. You know, I say to folks who say that humans don't contribute to climate change. I say, look, would you go into your garage and would you turn on your car in that closed space and would you just stay there for hours on end? Of course you wouldn't. I mean, you could lose your life ultimately that way. So we know that there are impacts. I mean, candidly, how much? We don't know. That's why we need more research. We do know humans are contributing to this, but we need to, and therefore we should take that into consideration in terms of our consumption. But then also we need more research. What should we be doing? Well, two things. And fortunately we are moving out on at least one of them, and that is we should be trying to proliferate the renewable sources. And you take a look now and you see that if you look in our county, we've got a fair amount of solar that's coming up. We don't have as much wind as in other places, but we have hydroelectricity. In fact, not far from here, we got a micro plant in Stuyvesant. Mm-hmm. So, what I would tell you is as we build out that capability, you know, that will be less reliance on the fossil fuels. And that will not only help us with the environment, but it's also going to help our foreign policy as well. I think we're actually making some progress on that. We got more to do for sure. But, you know, the other issue is how do we prepare for what's coming? Because it is coming. To those who may hold out hope that we're going to stop this changing climate, we're not going to be able to stop it. But what we can do is attenuate the effects. I believe we can attenuate the effects, and we can better prepare for it. So when you look at the Sandy Aid Bill, that Sandy Aid Bill was unprecedented. It was $60 billion in recovery aid for the seaboard, the eastern seaboard, and included $10 billion of aid for New York. $1 billion of that $10 billion for New York was for mitigation. Now, that's another way of saying, you know, dealing with climate change, right? You're talking about mitigating the future effects of storms such as like Sandy. So I was very encouraged that we got that in the bill. Here's the disappointing point is the fact that I can't believe this is legal, but evidently it's so. We've checked into it. You know, the state used over $200 million of that money to run ads on our TV to tell us that all was good in the economy. You ever notice that? You ever see those startup New York ads and everything like that? And you wonder where the money came from? It was actually the generous federal taxpayer dollars. It was the Sandy Aid money. It was diverted away from preparing for change and was put into those TV ads. How disappointing. Now, what should we be doing? Well, you know, when I met with like Joe Martens, who used to be the DEC commissioner, and some of his folks, who I have high regard for Joe, by the way, you know, the thing I argued is, look, use the power of software and, you know, automation and, you know, show the watershed, their various watersheds throughout New York, and then show what happens when you have an event, 10 inches of rain, 14 inches of rain, and show where this water is all going, because we have the analytics, we have the algorithm to at least make pretty good determinations about these things. And then, you know, using some of the latest techniques that one of them is called the Colorado technique, which is really how do you allow Mother Nature to breathe? How can we use floodplains in areas where, you know, we don't have populace right now, so you can take the energy out of the stream when you have these major events? Because if you rely on dredging, here's the challenge, is all you do is speed up the water when it's going downrange, and it becomes so potent and powerful, it takes out the community downrange. So in one of my communities in Delaware County, it was very interesting because the constituents were initially thinking, well, we should dredge. So here's what the awesome people in Delaware County, they had the power of the analytics. They actually showed the courses of action. They said, okay, well, let's try yours. And they actually showed what ended up happening is you hurt yourself, and then you end up with more damage. So what we should have been doing, and what I still hope we do, is we use those investments to actually help us in areas where we want to, you know, shape floodplains and, you know, make allow for the water to move into so that we can absorb, you know, these devastating storms, and we can do better about that. So in most cases, it would be allowing for breathing, you know, Mother Nature to do its thing. But in some cases, like if you have a community that can't move anywhere because it's already there, all right, well, then maybe a levee, there is some things we can do. But know that there is a second-order effect to some of that stuff, and you can actually model that in your computer simulation. So that's what really what we can be doing. By the way, one last thing. Our farmers, for example, here in Columbia County, I mean, it definitely got their attention. We had somebody from Cornell come to the Farm Bureau. We had the Farm Bureau dinner in the fall of 2014, and they laid out, you know, what's been happening. And it was pointed out that we have four new invasive species here in Columbia County. So our farmers, they realize that they're at risk in terms of their livelihood because of the changing climate. Now, to be sure, we're not feeling the same effects like Miami is, you know, in terms of the flooding that's going on in Miami. And even the salinity issue, because when you look at rising sea levels, it actually impacts. I've looked at some of the data in the
The Hudson River is
the Hudson River definitely. And by the way, that was part of the reason we had an issue with Sandy. If you look at Poughkeepsie and Kingston, it was the Hudson River rising at that point, and that's some of the flooding we had with Sandy. So, I do think there are some things that we can do. It's very disappointing that we've diverted some of that money for these commercials, which I think really were not the right way to go with that money. And I think as long as the people understand that, we can maybe have more accountability in our government.
But if we get more accountability in the government, is the government going to be accountable for helping the public work out the problem of reacting and mitigating even more, because there's obviously an issue here. You've identified it, but it doesn't seem that Congress is real willing to fund larger scale efforts. I mean,
yeah.
Is Congress doing enough? It doesn't sound like it is.
I will tell you that, you know, that Sandy bill, I think that was pretty forward leaning.
Was in response. You could couch that in response to a specific storm and a specific event, and saying this could happen again, that specific event. But to recognize the source of the problem and to get your party on board, especially, but anybody who doesn't matter what their party affiliation is, how do you do that? I mean, you haven't had much result.
A couple of things. First of all, I would say is in addition to Sandy, another place where you'll find resources, investments here is in the Department of Defense. You're going to find all your services and the Joint Chiefs. It's a wide recognition, right? Because, you know, the military, I mean, I always say, look, you know, in the military, you can try to create an alternative universe and live in it. It never works. It doesn't work. I mean, you have to live in the real world. And in the real world, bullets rip through flesh. So, you know, military guys are science-based. I mean, they have to be. So what you'll find is in the military, there's wide recognition of the science right now and in the changing climate across the world. So the military now has made investments in not only renewable energy, but actually energy efficiencies. So I want to point that out. And then as it relates to, you know, the attitude of the party, look, you know, I have said that if conservation is not conservative, then words have no meaning at all. So to me, if you want to be a conservative, you have to really be guarding resources. And that, whether it be budget resources or whether they be natural resources. And so, you know, this has been something I've tried to do to change. I did introduce a resolution, and I've gotten 13 Republicans to come with me. So it's not like the number is zero. It is building. And there's a pretty wide recognition.
Is it going to last, though? You've taken a leadership position, and you went out front on this. Mm-hmm. And regardless, you're leaving now, and so you're
I did a good handoff. No, there is. There's a good leader. Okay. His name is Carlos Carbello, and he is a representative from Florida. Mm-hmm. And sort of like in a military-style way, I mean, we did a good transition where, you know, I was leading, he was following, and then we were both sharing, and now he's actually leading, and I'm following. Mm-hmm. So he's ready. And, you know, I do think that this is going to be important for us going forward that, you know, by the way, I think it's also going to be good for the economy. This is a state that, I mean, we have so much potential. If you think about what we have, we're replete with natural resources and, you know, whether it be solar and wind, we have great places for wind in our state and also biomass. This is a state that could do really well in biomass, and to such a degree that I think we could actually export energy. And think about what that would do for jobs. That would be good for us in jobs. So I believe in this for all the right reasons. I think it'll grow the economy. It'll create jobs. That's what I think my party will really start to get on board when they see the job creation, the possibilities, they'll come. But then it also helps foreign policy. We'll be less reliant on foreign entities for
I want to move on to that quickly because we're coming to the end of the interview. And certainly in terms of foreign policy, you have some experience in the Middle East, having been stationed a number of times in Iraq as a commander of troops there. And I'm very curious about what your prognosis is in the near term, at least, for Iraq and for Syria. And are we on the right track there?
So it's really hard. We're not on the right track in Syria. Iraq is very difficult. And I think that what people should really take away from this is – you know, that before you make decisions like this, you really have to think it through. Because as soon as you broke this, as soon as you took out Saddam, Saddam was not a nice guy at all. He was a terrible guy, mistreated his people. But when we ended that regime, we have unleashed a series of consequences now, and they're not easy for us. So I did support the surge. Look, I've written a book about this, and I took the neoconservative approach to task. I believe in peace through strength, and I believe that's conservative. I have never supported the neoconservative approach, which I describe as, well, it's probably a little bit unfair, but very aggressive, let's just say, in the use of force. And I belong more to the, you might say, the realist school, which is, you know, if you have a strong deterrence, then you want to lead with your diplomacy, your commerce, and your trade. You want to lead with that. You don't want to lead with your chin all the time. So we're in a tough spot with Iraq. I supported the surge because once you broke it, you have a moral and a national security responsibility to try to stabilize it.
We got. I don't want to interrupt, but we do. We have 1 minute here, and I just wanted to ask you one question quickly. You were stationed also in military in the southwest for a while.
Yeah.
On drug interdiction. And can we build a wall that would keep you're familiar with that area? Can we keep all illegal immigration out by building a wall?
Well, it won't go to zero. I do think that there's more that we can do. The thing is that what we learned in the military is you construct an obstacle, but an obstacle is not effective unless you observe it. So, like, if you're an infantry guy.
So can we afford it?
It's going to be expensive. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's interesting because Donald Trump has said time and again that the Mexicans are going to pay for it. Yeah, and right. So this is very interesting to see what's going to happen. You know, it's interesting because you even saw Mr. Fox. He used to be the president of Mexico.
Yes.
And he did say, look, he's not for open borders. There is more that we can do.
Right.
And if anything.
But are you going to support Donald Trump?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I didn't vote for him in the primary. I'm a Christian. I believe that people can change. I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. So the question is, do I vote for Donald Trump or do I vote for a libertarian candidate or do I vote for somebody I've read somebody in? We'll have to wait and see. I'm going to watch the campaign. I want to be inspired. I think everybody out there, every listener, should make sure that they're inspired before they vote.
All right, we've got to go, but thank you so much
stopping
by.
Good luck with this
Chris
new
Gibson.
Show.
Yes, thank you for being on the first week's show.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you for your service in Congress.
WXC rocks.
You want to give us a station ID? Can you say you're listening to 90.7 WGXC Accra?
You are listening to 90.7 WGXC right out of Hudson and Accra. Please come back.
All right. Thank you very much for stopping by.
Thank you.